listening to a podcast from DCT Audio. I'm Dave Thomas, and I've been producing audio content for over 10 years. Thank you for listening to this edition of the programme. I do hope you enjoy it. I'm delighted to be joined today by the Yorkshire Indian, who's become a little bit of a media sensation over the last 6 to 12 months, I guess. You're very welcome on the podcast.
Hello, Astrid. Thank you for having me. I'm very, very fucking excited today. This means a lot to me to be on video. Where's the fucking video? Where's the camera?
It's a podcast.
Oh, okay. I see.
It's no video.
Old school.
Old, very old school.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay, I'm leaving now. Enjoy your takeaway. Thank you.
Cheerio. of course, the man behind the Yorkshire Indian is Bobby Sharma. Bobby, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
Now then, it's a bit of a surprise, I suppose, for some people. You don't actually speak with an Indian accent. Let's clear that up, first of all.
I don't speak with an accent, really, to be honest. So yeah, this is just a normal British accent, which is the Yorkshire. It's the hallmark of all accents.
Yeah, well, you've got to be careful what you're saying, because you've come from Yorkshire into Lancashire. I hope you brought your passport.
It's been stamped, checkpoint.
Good. Thanks for coming. I just wanted to explore, really, where you've got to from where you've come from, I suppose. And for me, that always comes back to childhoods and things, and we'll talk about that in a moment. For the character of the Yorkshire Indian, where did that come from?
It came mainly from childhood, really. Growing up, as obviously I was born and bred in Leeds. There was a lovely, like a community spirited area that I lived in Leeds 6. And obviously, having Indian parents, it's like everybody is your uncle and everybody's auntie. So it's like, it's just a mark of respect. You call people uncle, but they're not related whatsoever. But it's basically somebody who's similar age to your dad would be equivalent to your dad's brother. So you would call them uncle. And these were all like first generation, either from directly from India or via Kenya, Africa, etc. And they all have like heavy Indian accents. Me being born and bred here, schooled here, the vocab would have been a little bit higher than a grown man. So when they used to speak, it was like quite funny to listen to. And when they used to swear, because they'd pick up like swear words from either work or whatever, from their work colleagues, etc., but they couldn't say it properly. And that's basically where it comes from.
Got you. Probably a mix of quite a few family members, I suppose. I'm just curious, as to any of your relatives that picked up on your accent and go,
No, anybody probably is not living. But like say, for example, my dad didn't really swear at all. So it's definitely not from my dad, but he did have a slight accent. My mum used to swear occasionally, which was quite funny. But it was mainly the uncle, kind of either the drunk uncle, you know, because obviously people would go to the pubs, probably come back to the house, have something to eat or another drink with my dad, etc. And although my dad very rarely drank as well, but you'd always catch that uncle like, "Oh, you bastard, you're little," you know, like it's just from there.
Yeah. Now you mentioned your father, quite an interesting character, I believe. Your dad, he was quite well educated.
Yeah, he was a scholar, very educated. Long story, a very quiet man. Very quiet. You know, he kept all his emotions to himself. I didn't really know much about, you know, you're talking about the man behind the curtain. I didn't really know much about the man himself because he never really told a story. So you have to find these out later, especially when you're a little bit older as well. And I learned a lot more as well after he had a stroke and we were looking after him. And after he died, I found there's always an additional story. But his story, he was actually born and lived in a place called Lahore, which when he was born, it was part of India. And then during his childhood, it became Pakistan. So obviously they had to scarper and move to the border, which was Amritsar. That became literally the new border. And they were there as refugees. But he'd lost his mum and his dad when he was very, very young. And, you know, he told me one day a story about he was at school. His dad had already passed. He was at school with his brother, a sister as well. And his uncle had come to collect them from school early. And he was thinking, why have they come so early, etc.? And it was quite a long walk back to the house. And when they got back to the house, there was like a congregation of a lot of people there. Some were crying, etc. And his mum was literally there on the floor, covered in a white kind of like gown, etc., and from head to toe. Basically, she passed, and he cried and cried, and he said he promised himself he'd never cry again. And this is like a 6-7-year-old kid, promising himself not never to cry. And it explained a lot about my childhood with my father not really showing any emotion. He never used to. Obviously, he used to communicate with India a lot. He used to travel to India a lot. And, people used to die. People used to pass. And he never used to cry. And he never used to show any emotion, et cetera. And I never understood it. I thought maybe it's just an Indian thing. But it wasn't. It was just him. It was just the way he was. And even when my mum died, he was very, very upset. We know this from his health reasons, whatever, afterwards, because he died probably of a lonely heart. But he never showed any emotion then either.
You mentioned earlier before we started recording about this mixing pot of being brought up both as a British child and as an Indian child. And with you mentioning your father and how nobody ever cried and showed any emotions, but that sounds like quite a difficult childhood for you, having these two competing cultures, I suppose.
There was no competing culture. I mean, I had elder siblings. I was the youngest one. I was a little spoiled brat. I was the only one who was born here. Some of my siblings were born in Kenya and one or two were born in India. There wasn't really, I don't think there was a clash. It was more when you get home, because my parents were fairly religious, we're basically Hindus. And my mum used to do like religious things for the community, etc., cooking and whatnot. There was always something going on. We'd go to the temple, I'd go to the Gurdwara. There was always something going on. So it wasn't really like, oh, no, you can't do this, you've got to do this. It was just more, outside. The outside of the house is a different world. You come inside, it's like a different world. Obviously, my brothers and sisters, we all spoke English. Nobody spoke Hindi Punjabi. We all spoke Hindi Punjabi. You pick it up. But to each other, what I mean is we only spoke English. So it was like English is literally, predominant language that we spoke.
You mentioned cooking, obviously the Yorkshire Indian, that's what it revolves around. So how did cooking become a part of your life?
Basically my mother, she was, when people say, oh yeah, my mum's a really good cook, it's like, yeah, right. Oh, try to food. She was renowned to be, a really, really good Indian cook, traditional stuff, functions, parties, weddings. Birthdays. Those days we didn't really have caterers. The community would get together. The aunties would get together and go to the a commercial kitchen and start cooking. And it'd take them days, to prep and cook. And then my mum was always doing some kind of religious thing because in Hindu religion there's always something going on. And so she'd call the young children and the mothers, etc., to come to eat certain foods and do a religious thing. And then the aunties would come. When I say aunties, I'm on about the community women. Yes. Would come and they do religious things there. So yeah, I mean, she was renowned because the only reason I know this is because everybody said to me, I did pick a lot of stuff. We were kids, so we were obviously helping, sometimes forced to help, sometimes you can't play outside, you've got this to do. So we'd be making samosas for about 400 or 500 people from scratch. Those were the days. Now everything's manufactured, obviously you can get lentils, it's all power washed and the skin is taken off, etc. Then it's heat treated and then it's in a packet. Whereas before you'd go to the shop and it'd be in a massive sack and then you'd get a couple of scoops out. And then you'd have to get a wicker.
How do you peel level the wicker?
You don't peel them. You'd have to flick them one by one to find the stones. So there's a saying in Hindi, which is dal mein kuch kala, which is there's some black in the dal, meaning there's something not quite right there. It's a saying. It's not about black or white. It's about the stone. The stones are black. So what we do is we're sifting through each dal to get to the stones and discarding the stone. Can you imagine how long that would take? So that would be my job to do that, And then those were the days before, frozen peas would be shelling peas. I used to play in the streets. I was, lead six boy, I was a Yorkshire lad. We played in the streets, hopscotch, skateboard, BMX and the whole thing. I just wish I took a couple of days a week just to sit there and watch and take some notice, a little bit more notice and ask more questions. I never did.
Well, of course, you did ultimately become a professional chef, working some very, very long hours. So how long were you a chef for?
That's a strange one because I didn't actually start off as a chef, although I always cooked. I was in the restaurant trade as a young, kind of like a very young age, but it was more, it wasn't a family business or anything like that, you know, my brothers or my dad or anything like that. So I went into it and not really knowing much, but just working, because I've always, as a student, always worked in restaurant, whether it be brasserie, whether it be Italian, whether it be, you know, any type of Indian restaurant, whatever, I've worked there. And I always said, oh my God, you know, there's no way I'll ever go into the restaurant trade. These chefs, they're taking the piss. You know, it's like literally holding the managers to ransom. And I just thought, well, wait a minute, if I ever have a restaurant, I should be okay because I can cook. So nobody can hold me to ransom. And it actually worked that way. Nobody held me to ransom. You know, we had longevity where other restaurants were having high turnover. We were keeping the staff for like 8 years, 10 years, you know, not, they're not leaving. You know, grass is always green. They would lose a waiter here and a waiter there, but they come back. So I always just say to my staff, that door opens both ways. Don't ever leave on bad terms. Always leave on good terms. You know, you're welcome to go anywhere you want. It's your life. I wish you all the best, but just don't leave on bad terms. Because some people try to build things up, don't they, into a little argument. Don't leave on bad terms because you never know if you want to come back. The whole essence of Yorkshire Indian, when I started it many years ago, but just on a personal level, calling my food Yorkshire Indian, meaning I was promoting Yorkshire provincial food. Mm. So basically local farm foods, and then taking those products and produce and turning it into Indian classics. The whole idea is buy British, you know, buy British, buy local, support your farmers. You know, they're feeding us. They, you know, it must be really hard for a lot of these farmers as well, being dictated to by supermarkets, etc., price wise, and not making an honest living, or a good living, should I say. They need as much support as they can.
I know we've talked previously before the podcast, COVID came up, which for me at least, for this generation, was probably the single most damaging event for society that could have happened. There was so much fallout from that lockdown, the first one and then the second one. And in particular, people's mental health. I know, I think you found COVID quite challenging.
Well, it was challenging for everybody, really. I mean, at the first kind of like 5-6 weeks when we did that first lockdown, and everybody was like, what the hell's going on? And, you know, it turned into like a, you remember the school holidays we used to have when we were younger? It was like the 6-week holiday, and
yeah,
the sun
great,
used to shine every day.
Yeah.
And we'd be out in the streets till about 9:30, quarter to 10, and it used to be warm every day. Now, no rain. It was just like that. The sun just came out. We were in the garden. We were drinking wine. We enjoyed having barbecues. It was just like, wow. Then all of a sudden, it's like, wait a minute. We've had our 2 weeks now. Come on. And it extended. And then, obviously, you just go with the flow. You try to be a good citizen, not rock the boat, follow the advice, even though you don't really trust a lot of that advice of the government. But like I said, I never really get political, but I believe what I believe. But then the second one came, and that, I think that's what kind of got me. But then when the third one came, I think they notified us, Boris came on the screen on the 4th or the 5th of January 2021, and so we're locking the gyms down. I used to do a lot of running, like long distance running, what we call in England fell running. So I used to love doing that. It was great for my mental health. I used to cook all day on a Saturday. That was great for my mental health because it was soothing. I'd make about 4 or 5 dishes, you know, to last us a few days, etc. And then the running really, really did help my mind and my brain, and obviously my body as well. But then I had a little bit of an injury. I did a 50-mile ultra, and I aggravated my knee. I couldn't run for ages. I couldn't do squats. I couldn't do whatever. So I just started doing gym training, like weights and stuff. And that's really helped me. You know, I was training at home. You know, I bought some like kettlebells and some exercise bands and stuff. So I was keeping up to it. When the gyms kind of reopened, I started really training heavy and, you know, training really nice and getting a flow. Then obviously the lockdown freeze said all the gyms are closing again. I actually went down, you know, mentally for about what seemed like weeks. It was a 24 hours, you know, it was like 24 hour burst. And when I kind of like recovered, I was just like, oh, well, there's probably a lot of people out there that maybe not as strong as me. You know, I feel as I'm fairly strong-willed. That's struggling, people on their own, you know, maybe people that are struggling with like a parent in a care home or kids stuck in a house, etc. They can't go to work, you know, there were people struggling. So wouldn't it be a good idea to kind of like try and make, I had 23 followers. I was on TikTok and I think I was following about 5-6 people, 7 people. And I thought out of these 23, if I could make 5 people smile, then, you know, it's job done. It's like, you know, that's my job to do it. And I had a video already made because I used to post on my personal Facebook to family and friends who kind of like missed my food or had my food. And, you know, because I'm not in the restaurant trade anymore, I used to post a lot of pictures of my food, me cooking certain Indian classics to get a reaction. And people said, oh my God, that looks so nice, et cetera, et cetera. And I had this video because I made this, I think it was a chicken tikka or something from scratch. And so I had the video already there, but I'm not talking on it. It's just the video that I was going to post on Facebook. And I just decided to do like a little voiceover of an uncle, Indian uncle, just swearing, just being a bit silly. It wasn't really that deliberate. It was more, I was probably drunk at the time as well, because it was lockdown.
Well, I asked you, didn't I, who was your favourite chef? And you said Keith Floyd. And I must admit, when I watched your videos, the first person that came to me was Keith Floyd.
Yeah, well, yeah, big influence. I used to love his, I used to love his footage. I used to love his videos. I did like
them. He was a character, wasn't he?
And he always had a glass of wine in his hand. And I'm kind of like looking at myself now. I'm saying, I've always got a glass of wine in my hand. I think my wife's also, Keith always got a glass of wine. Why is this? So at least I can blame someone.
Yeah, I've got to say that your wife, your good lady wife, is sat right next to you as we're speaking.
Yeah.
She's got a bit of a wry smile on her face.
Don't talk about the stick that she's holding.
No, we won't mention the stick. You mentioned chicken tikka masala. Is that right? That was an English dish. It's not an authentic.
It's Scottish.
It's Scottish.
Yeah. Apparently the story is it was invented in Glasgow. A customer, you know, like chicken tikka, chicken. There's so many translations, like tikka actually means spicy. So it's like chicken spicy. But obviously, as we know in British Indian restaurants, chicken tikka is basically the marinated breast of chicken that's cubed, put in a skewer and cooked in a clay oven. So it's basically oven baked, if you like, which you'd serve either with a little bit of rice, some salad, and maybe a little bit of minted yogurt, some sauce, etc. But essentially, it's going to be a dry dish. So apparently, the story goes that a customer complained that it was too dry. So apparently the chef, and I forgot the name of the chef from the story, he quickly put something together rather than waste the chicken. He grabbed the chicken, put some kind of like a little bit of butter, a little bit of cream, some tomato and some spices, ginger, garlic, etc., and give it a little stir fry, made this sauce and added the chicken to the sauce. And apparently this is like the folklore story from either the 60s. I don't think it's the 50s, probably the 60s, that the chicken tikka masala then was given birth in a kitchen in Glasgow.
It's certainly a very popular dish, isn't it?
You can't get it in India.
You won't
get it in India. But the thing is, there's a lot of names are made up here in Britain just to make it sound exotic or make it sound a bit more authentic. But they're all made up. If you go to India and ask for chicken buna, or there is buna, but if you ask for a madras, you know, they'd look at you sideways. And if you ask for chicken tikka masala, they're like, what are you talking about? But butter chicken and things like that, murug makhani, these are dishes, but there's a lot of them are made up. I mean, I proved that point. I mean, I'm a restaurant owner. I'm always experimenting in the kitchen, new dishes, and I come up with about six dishes and I named them myself, but I gave them authentic names. And these were the best sellers in my restaurant. You know, they were good dishes, don't get me wrong, but the names were just completely made up. Didn't have nothing to do with the dish.
You kind of read my mind, because I was going to ask you, have you made or are the plans to, you know, curate and produce some of your own dishes? But you've done five or six. So what was your most, go and tell me about
the most popular actually. I called it the murug nawabi. Basically, there's a lot of chicken corn was a favorite with the ladies. You know, a lot of them like were worried about the cream, it's a bit fattening, it's this, it's that. You know, there's a lot more people getting a bit more health conscious. So I went out and I thought, well, what's going to be healthy? So chicken tikka is healthy because it's baked. There's very little oil in there, etc. So what I did was I jazzed up a little bit of a sauce with a tiny bit of ginger garlic, some fresh chilies, a little bit of mixed spice powders, some onions, some peppers, and basically coconut milk, a coconut cream, should I say, but a light one. Yeah. And simmered it down, and then basically added the chicken, and I called it the murug nawabi. And I said to a lot of the ladies, went out because I used to take the orders, etc., that look, this is like a low fat alternative to a korma. It's got a little bit of a kick, a little bit of spice. So it's a step up taste-wise. And when the word got out, it was just like one of the most popular dishes.
Wow. What is the secret to Indian cooking?
For me, it's trial and error. I mean, you know, you've got to understand, when I used to post on my own personal Facebook, a lot of people said, have you got a recipe? Send me the recipe. I'm like, recipe?
What's a recipe?
What are you talking about? And, you know, I do realise, I mean, obviously a lot of restaurants out there, like brasseries, you name it, the chefs have recipe books, you know, they curate them themselves, or they've got other people's recipes. And the Indian style of cooking, there is no recipe, you know, as in written. It's just trial and error. It's in your head. It's, you remember.
Handed down, I suppose.
Yeah, it's basically handed down. So then I had to, I think the first recipe I ever wrote, I think it was for my wife's cousin in Texas. And she messaged me and said, oh, will you send me chicken tikka masala recipe? And I had to kind of really apply myself, because I'm used to teaching people in person, side by side, to say, look, this is what you do next, this is what you do next, what you do next, and then repetition, hopefully they'll get it. And I'm like, oh, I'm not going to be there in person, so I need to really make sure this is concise. Then it's only when I read it, it's like there was four A4 pages of a recipe and method, because I wanted to really get it, you know, get the point across.
Yeah.
And I thought, this is too much, but I sent it anyway and never got word back. Probably too long. And it just goes to show, a lot of these recipe books and recipes, they're very obscure. They have the ingredients. They have a very vague method and a picture. Whereas I try to describe a little bit better, you know, my videos, and say, look, this is what you need to do. And this is the reason. Because there's reasoning, there's temperature control, there's certain stages, there's certain chemical reactions that take place with the onions, with the tomatoes, etc. There's a reason behind all of it, and this is why it tastes so much better if you do it right.
You posted a video the other day that you were commenting on. Some lady was putting chicken in water. Boy, it looks pretty, excuse the pun, it looked pretty foul to me.
Yeah, I mean, I do some reaction. I've got a lot of reaction videos out there. I need to do more, actually, because people do like them. But most of the time, obviously it's tongue-in-cheek. I'm not trying to criticise anyone's cooking. Actually, this lady in particular, I caught the video on, I think, Instagram. And then I followed her bio, and she was on TikTok, and I am on TikTok. So I thought, you know what, I'll do the right thing and message her. And she was actually a great sport. You should say, yeah, no problem, go for it. When I did the video, before I posted it, I said, look, I've done the video, I'm going to post it soon, but I will tag you in. It might be beneficial for you, but you're not going to like the video. And she said, no, no problem, I cook like that for my content, I'm happy with it. And she was more than happy. So that's the way she cooks. It wasn't a comedy act.
So going back to your videos, you mentioned that you started out on TikTok and had 20 followers or whatever. So what changed that has brought you to the place you are today, I suppose? Because I think you're close to 500,000 followers.
Yeah, I think that video changed everything, really, because obviously now I have my phone. I have like four channels, and I'll go pop into each one to check the notifications. You do that probably. It's just muscle memory now. You pull the phone out and say, right, you know, what's happening here? Loads of notifications. Whereas because I was new to TikTok and it was locked down, I wasn't really that bothered, and I didn't have the muscle memory to check the notifications. So I checked back after about 3 days to see what was going on. And from 23 followers, I'd got to 2,000 just from that one video. And I'm like, what is going on? And I started reading the comments. Oh, could you do this? Could you do this? Yeah. Could you do that? And I did another couple of videos to teach people authentic. But then what people wanted to know was, how do I make one of those boonas? How do I make a madras, you know, the restaurant takeaway style? Then I thought, well, wait a minute. I'm not going to go back into the trade. I know how to do it. I could teach people how to, you know, run a takeaway or run a restaurant now. No problem. So I can easily teach somebody how to cook at home. So why not? Then I decided to keep it kind of like a little bit comedy for people. And a lot of people did not get it at all.
Really?
I did get a lot of hate.
Really?
Got a lot of blowback. A lot of blowback.
You surprised me.
A lot. Especially, I mean, I don't like the word Asian, because I don't consider myself as Asian, although India is in Southeast Asia. I call myself either British, or if you want to push it, then yeah, call me Indian, you know, if you don't want to include me, but don't call me Asian. But like I say, from the Asian-y background, people that just didn't like it. I got a lot of hate messages and, you know, you're this, you're that. I used to block them.
Was it a case of you're being a bad role model? I don't know.
Maybe, but I wasn't trying to be a role model for anybody. I was just being comical. It's just like my brand of comedy. It's you know, if you knew me and I wasn't online, I'd be making jokes like that.
Anyway. Yeah.
But I can't change. I've just always been the joker. I've always been the life and soul of the party. I don't mean any harm. I don't step on anyone's toes. I don't do it on other people's expense. I do it if it's willing and it's banter and, you know, no problem. Otherwise, it goes into the bullying side of things.
How do you manage 500,000 followers?
It's a strange one because, you know, you say 500,000. What happened was, you know, after lockdown, and I did get a lot of followers really quickly, especially on TikTok. But then after the weeks and weeks and started moving on, life comes back to normal. And you think, well, wait a minute, I've still got to earn some money here. You know, if I was 18 and I was living with my mum and dad, and you know, I'd be in the attic upstairs and I'd be doing like 5-6 videos a day, no problem. But like say, life goes, you know, you've still got to pay bills. You've still got to, you know, help the kids. They were both studying at the time, etc. My wife didn't really understand it as much as well. So she tried to keep me grounded and said, look, yeah. You know. So what social media need is they need content. You have to keep posting. And if you don't post, you wither and die. That's basically what I did. I kind of like left it for a while and posted now and again, and then made a comeback after 3 months, and then I'd left it. And then, you know, you had a bit of time, had a weekend free or whatever. Yeah. So, right, I'm going to put some content. The point I'm trying to make is I think if I'd have carried on the way I'm putting the content out now, I'd probably be a lot more than like a million, over a million on each one. And I'm not just like bigging myself up or anything like that. I think it's just the way I would have been pushed forward by the social media platforms, because this guy's getting busy. He's getting loads of reactions. Let's push him a little bit higher. But now I just have to make sure I can push and not let people down. I've got a duty of care to a lot of followers out there. There's a lot of people, let's say, still struggling with mental health, that maybe rely on certain people online to cheer them up. And, you know, maybe I'm one of them. You know, I don't know. But the target's still the same, 5 people. It doesn't really make a difference as 500,000 or 50. As long as I can make 5 people smile, I'm happy.
And you're quite right. You just never know who's listening and the effect that it can have on somebody.
That, I mean, and that's the whole point. It's like, if you save one person, or, you know, you help one person, then that's job done. I always, you know, say to my wife as well, I can't really change my character, as in Bobby Sharma, what's inside me. If I try to change it, I lose the essence of me. If I'm not as charitable as I am as a person, if I don't help people, I'm always there to help people. And yes, you know, obviously we've been together many, many years, and she has seen me get taken advantage of, you know, people taking advantage, taking what they wanted and then moved on. Mm-hmm. She's seen that and she despises it. And then, but the thing is, who can she blame? She tries to blame everyone else, but then I'm the one still there. So she's like, you need to change. But she's realised now, I just can't. I'm just, you know, I'm not a pushover. I'm not gullible. I've got to be me. So this is what I'm doing with the Yorkshire Indian, just trying to be me. And the idea behind it is to help people.
I think, well, I mean, I had 6 months out of work because of mental health issues. And one thing I learned that, when somebody is nasty to you, it's never about you. It's them. And that takes a bit of getting your head around. But once you do, it becomes a lot easier to understand, I suppose.
Yeah, but then they lose out. They lose out on you. The relationship's dead. And then the person that helped them, that would have done anything for them, they don't have that person anymore.
No, that's
where. And that's where they lose out. Whether it be friends, whether it be family, whether it be whoever. You don't have me anymore. Simple. You're not getting any of me. Goodbye.
Yeah, well said. So, Yorkshire Indian, what are the plans for the future?
Well, you know, just a little bit more of the same. You know, I need to kind of like... But there's so many things, I mean, that I have to do, obviously, with video-wise, content-wise. Keeping up with the content is one massive juggling act. It's a balancing act as well. I mean, I do cook. We're always cooking. Mm. But sometimes... Can I be bothered setting up a camera and then editing the video and doing this and doing that? And like I said before, just early on, that a lot of people didn't get my content. A lot of people actually do get it. You know, the ones that they realize it's a joke, it's comedy. He's not completely serious, you know. I stay away from, obviously, politics and stay away from religion. That's 2 things I promise myself to stay away from. And then I think over the years now, people have started to realize, actually, he's onto something. And so I'm getting a lot more interest from brands and sponsors, etc. They're looking at all that, look at the views, and they're saying, you know what, we want to be part of this. And I think they're just turning around now and saying, yeah, he's always been there. We've missed out. So he's onto something.
Am I right in thinking that you've done, I'm sure I've seen some videos, you're doing like a live roadshow in front of an audience, which do you know what that reminded me of? I mentioned it to you when we were texting, is the, we're of a similar age. There used to be a program called The Galloping Gourmet, didn't they?
He would cook
a meal and then he'd invite somebody from the audience to sit down and have the meal with him. A very popular TV show in the 70s. And it just reminded me of that.
Well, if I invited one person from an audience to join me, it'd be a riot. There would be a riot. I mean, last time we did that demo, because it was down south, it was quite far away. We only brought so much kind of fresh produce to cook and whatever. And it was supposed to be just for samples and demos. But everybody, I said, anybody like to try? Everybody got up. And I started panicking. I was like, well, there's not going to be enough food here. Then people started requesting, oh, you didn't make a veg one. Could you make a side? I started cooking a veg dish like it was a pop takeaway. Then, because it was a festival and there was loads of food stalls, people saw those people stood up and thought, oh, that's another stall and the food smells lovely. Let a queue up. So people started queuing up behind.
Wow.
With their cash ready to buy whatever I was selling. And I wasn't selling anything. Oh, my God. So, yeah, there'd be definitely be a riot if I just chose one person.
You've very, very kindly brought me a spice tin, which I've seen on your website. It is a lovely piece of stainless steelware, I have to say. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
What are the basic spices that I should be putting in that tin then?
The basic ones that I recommend, obviously, to go with, if you're making British Indian restaurant style with the curry base that I do, I would go with turmeric, which is haldi. You've got some Kashmiri chili powder or just normal chili powder would be fine. You can get like a medium or a hot one now. Coriander powder, which is dhania powder, basically. Cumin powder, which is jeera powder. Tandoori masala powder, which is basically a blend of about seven kind of like soft spices that work really well with chicken tikka and tandoori chicken. Garam masala, which is a blend. Garam basically means hot. Masala means spice, so hot spices. There are about 8 to 10 whole spices that go in that garam masala. They really, really complement. I'd probably recommend paprika. And sometimes I have some chili flakes to the side if I need to add certain things, but usually I use fresh chilies. So those are did I give 8? Yeah, I think I gave 8. And then hot Madras curry powder, which is, curry powder is a bit of a bastardization from, you know, the British Empire times when they were bringing a lot of spices back. Yeah. And they made curry powder first, and the yellow kind of like where we invented mustard with, etc., you know, from the curry powder. They mixed all the cheaper kind of like spices together to sell back to bring back to Britain and to Europe. And then there's hot Madras powder, which a lot of restaurants use, but I use that just for the curry base. And it's all in my recipes as well. Anybody wants to go to YouTube at Yorkshire Indian, all my recipes are there. Don't forget to subscribe, you cheap, tight little. It's free. Thank you.
Well, it's been an absolute delight speaking with you today, Bobby. Thank you so much for coming over from Yorkshire and your lovely wife, Shadna. Just finally, where people can find you on social media.
So social media handle is at Yorkshire Indian, all one word. And you can find me on YouTube, Facebook, you can find me on Instagram, and you can find me on TikTok, if you're that way inclined. Also, I have a website, which is yorkshireindian.com. But yeah, it's been a pleasure. Thank you very much for having me. I hope you enjoy, make loads of use of that spice tin.
It's
called a masala dabba. You know, I'm sure you're quite accomplished in the kitchen, so it's going to come in handy. Hello to all of Preston and all of the UK and whoever else is listening. I am actually internationally known now. I'm getting, you know, Australia,
Bradford.
USA, Bradford. Well, I don't know about Bradford. You know, Australia, USA, France, Spain, South Africa.
Wow.
I'm getting a lot of love and a lot of messages, and it's amazing. The internet's an amazing thing. You're all of a sudden, you're worldwide, you know, so yeah. I love it. I do love it. So thank you very much, and much love to all of you, you bastards.
DCT Audio. The art of good listening. Thank you.